KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The teenage brain can be a mystery to adults. Between the ages of 12 and 24, it changes in dynamic and sometimes frustrating ways. UCLA psychiatry professor Daniel Siegel debunks myths about adolescence to show how teens learn new skills, connect with others, and demonstrate limitless creativity. Siegel is the author of Brainstorm: The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He spoke at Town Hall on December 13th, 2013, in a lecture presented by ParentMap.
Thank you all for being here, and I'd like to thank ParentMap and the sponsors for tonight's evening. And thank you for coming out on such a cold evening in Seattle. It was great to land here and see this beautiful city, but also to then be reminded that we don't always have this kind of cold, and to appreciate the warmth that I know you have. I know you say you have clouds here, but I don't believe it. Every time I've come, it's been sunny here. Isn't that true? You're just hiding it from California, this beautiful emerald city. So what we're going to talk about today is adolescence, and we're going to really explore the world of the adolescent period. So let me just ask you, how many of you have adolescents right now in your homes? Let's just see. Wow, okay, great. And how many of you are still in your adolescence right now? But actually in age between 12 and 24. Let's start with that. We have some adolescents in the room? Great. And how many of us once were adolescents, of course? That's all of us. So hopefully these things will be relevant, these ideas we're going to talk about. And we'll be exploring them in a number of different ways. I'll just start by saying that at home, we have the phase, my wife and I, that we call the flexibility phase, because both of our kids have launched from the house. One is in the middle of college, the other is out of college. They're both at the end of their teen years. One is almost 20 and the other is 24. So in the days when I was writing earlier books like Parenting from the Inside Out with Mary Hartzell or The Whole Brain Child with Tina Bryson, the kids were younger, and people would say, when are you going to write a book on teenagers? And I'd say, you know, someone who has teenagers at home would know better than to try to write what's going on, because it's so confusing. So I waited until they were done with their teenage years, but then I was surprised to find that the research that's about adolescence reveals that this period of life, which can be defined very simply as the period between childhood dependence and adult responsibility, this period is at least a dozen years long if you look at the studies of the brain, that the brain is actually remodeling itself during this period between 12 and 24. So the teenage term doesn't apply to the end of adolescence. So you can have, as I do, one offspring in his 20s, he's 24, he's still an adolescent. And we have to realize that these changes happen like that. So when I got into looking at what the science is, I'm trained as a scientist, both beginning in college with biochemistry, but later on in medicine, studying actually the impact of relationships on our medical health, and then studying the way in which relationships shape our minds. What I learned to try to explore what happened during this period is that there's a lot of new science about the adolescent mind, about the adolescent experience of feelings and thoughts and attention and behavior, that actually is very inconsistent with what we were told in parenting books and in popular media in general about adolescence. So this was kind of a shock that there were these myths that were there. And the thing that really hit me as this project was unfolding was that the myths were not only wrong, but that if you believed them as an adolescent or as an adult, they would actually make the time more difficult during the adolescent period. So what I want to first review for you is what these myths are, and then see what the science now tells us about them. And let's take a moment and let's turn our cell phones off. And it's always like a Rorschach test to do that, to see what people have as their ringers. Did everyone hear that ringer? Yes. Although there is a great meditation that I did with a colleague of mine, Jack Kornfield, recently, where we had everyone turn on their cell phones to ringer mode. And then we tried to do a calm, reflective practice. And there were about this many people in the room. And so I didn't know if a phone would go off. So I was ready to actually just call Jack to make sure at least one ringer went off. But for the 20-minute period, there must have been 300 rings that went off at different times. So you had to try to stay calm in the face of it. So this focus of attention about this ringer is exactly what we're going to talk about the adolescent mind. Because the way the mind changes is by a change in the remodeling of the brain. So luckily, ParentMap has been really, really kind to all of us. And as I'm going to go through these myths, it's going to be very helpful to reach underneath your bench. And underneath your bench is taped a model of the brain that you can take home with you. So if you reach underneath the bench and feel under there, see if you can find it. If you pull your arm out from under the bench, you'll find there's a hand attached to it. This is your handout for tonight. And this is my daughter says, don't ever say this, Dad, so don't tell her I said this. It's a handy model of the brain. And it's if you bend your thumb in the middle and bend your fingers over the top, this brain model would be situated in your actual head like it is in my head here. And we're going to review the basic parts of the brain. How many of you are familiar with the hand model of the brain, just so I can get a feeling for it? Wow, look at Seattle. Let's hear it for you. Very good. That's awesome. So this hand model of the brain is very useful, as you know, and we're going to review it so we can understand when scientists tell us that the brain is remodeling. We need to ask the question, how is that happening? Where is that happening? And what's its impact on mental processes like feelings and thoughts and the ability to pay attention and things like that? So we're going to take your hand model of the brain, and you are welcome to take it home with you. That's fine. And we're going to review the parts. And as we do that, we're going to go through the myths at the same time and then debunk them and see what the actual truths are. Okay, so let's go through our hand model just so we get an orientation. If you lift up your fingers and lift up your thumb, this is now looking deep inside the brain. Let's get ourselves oriented. Up through your backbone is the spinal cord, which is, I'm going to ask you to repeat things, because what we know about memory now is if you can engage in learning rather than passively just have things flung at you, but actually actively wrestle with them, you'll remember them better. So what's in the backbone? Very good. And that's represented in your wrist, the spinal cord. And it comes up and brings all the information from the body, which means your muscles and bones and from your organs of your body, including your intestines and your heart, we'll talk about later. And we now know that around the intestines and around the heart, there are neural networks that seem to process extremely important information. And one way to remember it is the wisdom of the body. So the wisdom of the body comes up through the spinal cord, and also, since I know this is a very, you're very familiar with the hand model of the brain, we'll say it's also the 10th cranial nerve that is bringing information up, the vagus nerve. And all of this body stuff comes up, and it first gets passed through the deepest part of the brain, which is in your palm, and that's called the brain stem. So in the palm is represented the... Very good. And the brain stem is important for a number of different things. It regulates your heart rate, what your intestines are doing, so your basic physiological processes. It also has clusters of the basic cells of the brain, which are called the neurons. What are the basic cells of the brain? Neurons, very good. And neurons connect to each other through synapses, the connections. And what do the synapses do? They connect the neurons. And so in the brainstem, you have clusters of neurons called nuclei or groups. And these groups are responsible for something you're probably very familiar with, which is the fight, flight, freeze, and faint response. You may never heard of the faint part, but we now know there are four different reactive states you can get into. So you fight back when you're threatened. You can flee, you know, run away. You can freeze, which means you tighten up your muscles and get, you know, don't move. or you can collapse, and that's the fainting part. And so we all have different ways that we respond to threat, and I'll give you a feeling for that actually right now, just so you can get a sense of what the brainstem can feel like as before we go to the higher parts of the brain. So just let yourself take in what I'm about to do, and just bring into awareness whatever comes up from your body or your feelings, your thoughts, your images, anything. And I call that sifting your mind. The sensations from your body is S. Images that might come to mind, I. Feelings that might arise, F. And T are thoughts. It's just a simple acronym to remember how you explore the inner world. So right now, you're going to let yourself sift whatever happens. And I'm going to say a few words, and I'm going to pause, and then I'm going to say a few other words. And all you need to do is let these things sift through you in your awareness. You ready? And you might like to just close your eyes, put your pen down. This will be an experiential exercise. No. 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 Yes. 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 And now before we discuss this exercise, try putting one hand on your heart and one hand on your abdomen and put a little pressure. See how that feels. And now switch it out, put the other hand that's on the abdomen on the chest, the one on the chest on the abdomen, put a little pressure, see how that feels. And now put it whichever way you felt most comfortable. Okay, that's great. And if your eyes are closed, you can let them come open. If you like your hands where they are, you can keep them there, but we're going to continue the talk. So let's just do a quick survey on the hand thing. How many of you felt that one way or the other, it actually felt comforting to put a hand on the chest and a hand on the belly? Raise your hand really high. Really high. Okay, so the vast majority of people. Okay, let's just do a quick survey. How many felt that the right on top was the best combination for you? Raise your hand really high. Okay, and how many felt the left on top was the best combination? Okay, it's so fascinating. Is there anyone interested in getting a PhD? Okay, here's what you need to do. No one on the planet knows why. It's always the same. It's 3/4 of people have a right on top preference, 1/4 left on top preference, and it's not correlated, as far as I can tell, to left-handedness or right-handedness. Can you figure that out for us? Because you have an instant control group, right? So you can do the study. Well, forget it. We can talk about it later. But no one knows. But the issue is that it's comforting. And I actually did a study of this, of one subject, me, and I took some physiological measures of one way that I feel good. I'm a left on top guy. And I did the other way, and my physiology was completely different when the good way versus the not good way. Completely changed the whole coordination of my nervous system. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. But anyway, that's just a little interesting academic issue. But let's come back to the benefit of this. When you're feeling distressed, doing it the way that's comfortable for you can actually change your physiology. And there's reason to believe, although when you get your PhD, you're going to come back here to this town hall and tell us about it. There's reason to believe it actually also changes the way your brain works, because your brain does not work separately from your body as a whole. They come together. Now let's come back to the yes-no experiment. How many of you felt, starting with the first question, a difference between the feeling inside of you with no and with yes? Raise your hand, please. Okay, take a look around. Okay, so just shout out some words. What did no feel like? Just shout out some words. Frustrating, angry, jarring, frightening, Stressful. Fearful. Disheartening. Anxious. Freezing. Scary. Okay. Sorry. I'm sorry about that. Yes. And shame. And shame. Okay. Now, I'm not even your father yelling at you with a no, right? I'm just some dude saying some stuff up here. No. Now, let's go. What did yes feel like in contrast? Soft. Happy. Soothing. Comforting. Acceptance. Yes. Inviting. Open. Calming. Gentle. Okay? Now, it's really, really important to remember the experience you just had, because the brain has these two fundamental states. One is a state we're just going to name reactive, and that's the no state. And the other is a state we're just going to call receptive. That's the yes state. And the reason that I wanted you to learn also the hand positioning thing is because putting the hand in the way that feels good brings you to a receptive state. So if you don't have someone bringing you, saying yes to you, you can actually say yes to yourself. So it's a way to bring yourself from reactivity to receptivity. Now, the thing about this basic way the brain works is that the brainstem is interacting with the next part of the brain. Put your thumb over, and we're going to go to that. The limbic area, which includes a region you may be familiar with, the amygdala. And these work together to create, with the body, our emotions. And part of what happens with our emotions is this, you know, reactive or receptive state we get in. So one of my colleagues wrote a book called The Polyvagal Theory, Steve Porges. It's a part of our series of books that I oversee the publication of. We have 36 textbooks, for those of you who like the science books, called the Norton Series on Interpersonal Neurobiology. So we have 36 books where you can read the details of what I'm going to give you the take-home messages about. So the take-home message here is that the limbic area works with the brainstem and the body to create your emotions.
Daniel Siegel, the author of Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He spoke at Town Hall on December 13th, 2013, in a lecture presented by ParentMap. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at KUOW Speakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Daniel Siegel in a moment, 9:24, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow we are going to get a review of the week's news with Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, and Luke Burbank, host of LiveWire. Topics on the agenda include, do you think Seattle is a liberal bastion? Maybe you should think again. Also, the Seahawks, Richard Sherman, and Super Bowl 48. And the problems with drilling the new tunnel under Seattle. It's all tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Boat Show, with more than 1,000 boats on display, January 24th through February 1st at CenturyLink Field and South Lake Union, with a shuttle between locations. Tickets online at seattleboatshow.com. Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore, an independent bookseller with 9 locations that offer thousands of new and used titles, Husky gear, and gift items. Learn more about upcoming author events and store locations at ubookstore.com.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What's going on inside the teenage brain? Psychiatry professor Daniel Siegel debunks myths and presents the facts in his new book, Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He illuminates how this period of growth can actually be positive for both children and parents. He spoke at Town Hall on December 13th, 2013, in a lecture presented by ParentMap. Next, he continues to discuss parts of the brain.
This limbic area is very important with working with the brainstem to motivate you. And what's really interesting about adolescence, as we're going to now dive into, is that changes in the structure of the brain, which alter the way the brain's functioning, actually make it so emotions are more intense in adolescence. Not because of the first myth we're going to debunk, which is, how many of you have heard the myth that raging hormones make adolescents act the way they do? Raise your hand if you've heard that myth. It's just not true. Hormones rise because of puberty and certainly influence any of us at any age. That's true. But it's not raging hormones that lead to adolescent changes in feelings, thoughts, and behavior. So that's the first myth we have to get rid of. And the truth is that there's a change in structure we're going to review that makes it so emotions are more influential on the way the higher parts of the brain work, as you'll see soon. So that's the first thing, is emotion. The second combination of the limbic area and the brainstem is also changing, and so adolescents are motivated differently. So how many of you have heard the myth, this is the second myth, that adolescents are lazy? Anybody hear that? Not so many. Well, you're afraid to raise your hands. People are laughing. Anyway, I do a lot of teaching now with middle schools and high schools, and I ask the teacher how is it going? They say it's not going well because they're just not motivated. They're so lazy, they say. Well, I say, well, what are you doing with them? And as you'll see, they keep on treating them as if they're just children who are a little bit older. But in fact, adolescents are not just children with a few more years under their belt. There's a huge change in the motivational system in the brain that we're going to review soon. And it comes from these limbic and brainstem changes. And if you want to read a deep book about that in general, here in Washington State, a beautiful book by Jaak Panksepp and Lucy Bivin called The Archaeology of Mind, also in our series. Fantastic book about these subcortical, because the cortex is the next area we're going to talk about, below the cortex influences on motivation and emotion. The third really important thing that the limbic area is really crucial for, and to know about this in adolescence is essential, it is something called appraisal. And appraisal is a word we use in science just to say, how does the brain evaluate the meaning of something either coming from the outside world or from the inner world of thoughts and feelings? So it's basically an evaluative system that's housed in this limbic thumb area. So the evaluation would be something like, is what's happening right now worth me paying attention to or not? That sound familiar? So when teachers say to me, these kids are lazy, I say, no, they're having changes in the way their limbic system is working, and you don't know how to connect with their limbic system. So they don't care about what you're saying. Right? I mean, you know, but you can teach teachers and parents how to relate a different way so that the limbic area is connected to. So this appraisal system basically says, number one, should I put energy into this thing and pay attention? Then once I've paid attention, it says, bless you. In fact, let's have a bless you for everyone who's going to sneeze tonight. So the appraisal center also says, well, it says first, is this worth paying attention to? Then once I've paid attention to it, is it good or bad? And if it's good, how do I get more of it? And if it's bad, how do I get less of it? And then you elaborate those appraisals into what we call emotional states, you know, happiness, joy, surprise, disgust, anger, fear, this kind of stuff. So this appraisal system of the limbic, with its limbic origins, is going to spread out and influence how we feel. And feelings are everything when it comes to the mind. They're everything. So these areas, sometimes people call them the emotional centers. They're not really emotional centers. They're everything centers. They influence everything. So appraisal also changes in adolescence. So instead of them being raging hormones or, you know, they're lazy or something like that, it turns out that the limbic area changes its assessment of whether that you should really be listening to adults or not. Seriously. Now you may say, well, wait a second, that's a little weird. Why would a limbic area change like that? Well, picture this. Just imagine this scene. And the baby crying is a good thing to just cue you for what I'm about to say. Imagine that the sun is slowly coming up. You've had a really great sleep. And someone who loves you more than anybody in the world, who's crazy about you, comes in and kisses you gently on the forehead and says, "Good morning, sweetie. What would you like for breakfast?"
"I shall have a little cereal, Mom."
And you get up and you go to the bathroom and you come and you go have your cereal. You get dressed, and then let's say you go to preschool, and then you play with some toys and play with some friends and you learn how to share, and then you have a snack, and then you maybe take a rest, and then you come home and have a little lunch, and then you take a full-on nap. And then you turn on some music and you dance around, and then maybe you watch some cartoons. And then someone says, "Hey, sweetie, what would you like for dinner?" And you have a dinner, and then it's getting late, so you get in the tub, and they scrub you down. And then they put you in bed, and they sing you a song, and they read you a story, and you drift off to sleep. Now, who in their right mind would leave that setup? Right? So nature is no fool. Nature knows that if you're going to get that situation to change, if you're going to get that kid to get ready to leave that setup, you've got to do something to that brain that makes it act differently. Because if it didn't, you'd never leave. Right? In fact, I know a lot of people try to get their spouses to recreate that setup for them. You know what I mean? That's a whole nother talk. So the limbic area's got to change. It's got to change. And just to finish up the set, we have emotion, we've got motivation, we've got appraisal. The two other things the limbic area is important for are memory, different aspects of memory, emotional memory, ways of interpreting things and remembering the emotional meaning of them, and something called attachment. Attachment is how we as mammals need to depend on older, wiser, stronger figures in our life. Usually there are parents, and in human beings they're actually not just the parent. There's something called alloparenting, where we as a species have always had more than one attachment figure, that it's the parent and others. So Sarah Hardy's beautiful book, HRDY, Mothers and Others, describes how not only is this an important thing about how we raise our kids, that we have others besides the parents, but it probably shaped who we are as a species, that we learned to be collaborative because we started with sharing in collaborative child rearing. It's a hugely important issue. Anyway, the attachment that we have as human beings, of course, we can have a number of different attachment figures, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but the key for attachment are these four S's. You are seen by your attachment figure, who sees the mind beneath behavior. You are safe with your attachment figure, meaning two things. Meaning, if you're in danger, your attachment figure protects you. And it also means that your parent doesn't terrify you. And if they do, that's a violation of the basic tenet of attachment that needs to be repaired. Because as parents, and I try to write this in the books I've written, you know, we all do things that can terrify our kids. If we do, we should make a repair, because it's a huge, huge violation to the way the brain is organized. So you're seen, you're safe. The third S is soothed, that when you're in a state of distress, the interactions with your caregiver bring you to a state of calm. And if you're lucky, as about 2/3 of the population in the United States is, you have a secure attachment, which is the fourth S. And security comes from being seen, being safe, and being soothed in a relatively predictable way. And when there's violations in any of those things, they're repaired. Because there's no such thing as perfect parenting. We all goof up, even if you write books about this stuff. And the reason I always put my goof-ups in there is so we can see how would you make a repair. And when I've asked my kids to review the goof-up, and they turn to me and say, "Okay, I read it." And I said, "Well, what do you think?" They go, "Well, it's accurate." but why would you this put this in a book on parenting? Because you look like a jerk. I said, well, as long as it's accurate, if you think I look like a jerk, then that's exactly what I want in the book. You know, because you can always make a repair. You can always course correct. And the reason I wrote the Brainstorm book for both adolescents and adults, knowing how difficult that would be to write because there's nothing written like that, and now I understand why, because it's the hardest book I've ever written, you know, find a voice that reaches across the generational divide like that. But my hope for the book is that it'll increase the ability to communicate as long as both parties are willing to dive into what they're going through and try to really honestly communicate with each other. So attachment, how does attachment need to change, this fifth function of the limbic area in adolescence? You've got to have a shift in the limbic area's basically election of who to turn to when you're distressed. Who does an adolescent turn to when they're in a state of distress? Peers, not parents. Now, for many of us, and I'll fess up to it, I felt really rejected. It felt terrible when my daughter would start turning to her friends and not to me or my wife. When our son would go to his friends and not to us, it felt really bad. We would question ourselves, what's wrong with us as parents? Why aren't they coming to us? But when you think about it, to change your mindset from that snuggly situation where you're always dependent on your parents, you've got to have a change in the limbic attachment that gets a child to turn into an adolescent, which means you're getting ready to leave home. It's not a period of immaturity. This is another myth to debunk. People think adolescence is a period of immaturity. It's not. It's a period of necessary transformation, and the necessary transformation is for the individual to get ready to leave home, number one, but on the bigger evolutionary scale, we believe, we in science, that the reason that human beings have populated every aspect of this planet is because of the courage and creativity of adolescents.
Daniel Siegel, the author of Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He spoke at Town Hall on December 13th, 2013, in a lecture presented by ParentMap. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Daniel Siegel in a moment, 939, 94.9 KUOW. Tomorrow night we're going to hear stories of people gaining the upper hand over forces inside them, like unhealthful urges and creative insights that seem to have a mind of their own. Example, a Cold War negotiator backs himself into a tactical corner in order to quit smoking. Also, a visit to a clinic in Russia where patients endure a radical treatment to help fight their demons. And Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert on doing battle with your muses. It's all on Radiolab tomorrow evening at 7. Forecast for tonight, lows 30s to lower 40s, partly cloudy, patchy fog after midnight. Friday highs near 50, partly sunny with patchy fog in the morning, then becoming sunny. The Austin-based quartet Jitterbug Vipers talk with Michael Feinstein and play some of their 1930s-style Viper Jazz, an underground take on swing classics by Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Cab Calloway. That begins in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from PCC Natural Markets, offering a selection of game day food in the PCC Deli, including take-and-bake pizzas and dips and spreads, with 9 neighborhood locations. More at pccnaturalmarkets.com. Support for KUOW comes from Northwest Associated Arts, presenting an evening with Garrison Keeler, host of Prairie Home Companion, sharing anecdotes about growing up in the American Midwest, the people of Lake Wobegon, and late life fatherhood. April 1st at Benaroya Hall. Tickets at benaroyahall.org or box office.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Daniel Siegel is a professor of psychiatry at UCLA and the author of Brainstorm: The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. In it, he discusses how a deeper understanding of brain science can bridge the gap between teens and adults. Siegel spoke at Town Hall on December 13, 2013, in a lecture presented by ParentMap.
Because what happens in the brain, and the story I'm going to tell you now, and let's just finish the brain model so you can see all the circuits. We've got the brain stem. What's the thumb again? The limbic area, very good. And let's just go over its five functions. It's got emotion, motivation, appraisal, memory, and attachment. Okay, so those are big changes when we say the limbic area is changing. The top of the brain is called the outer bark or cortex or neocortex or mammalian cortex, all the same thing. It's an outer layer. It's huge. It has a lot of cells in it that respond to experience in a big way. So that's called neuroplasticity. Basically, if you had to say what the cortex does, is it makes maps of different things. So even though I know there's a whole bunch of hype about finding out the connectome, which is the word now that's being used to talk about finding all the ways these neurons are connected to each other, your connectome and my connectome, and in fact all of our connectomes, are unique because genes are influencing how they connect, and all of our genes are different. Epigenetics is changing how neurons connect to each other. Epigenetics are the non-nucleic acid molecules. You know, genes are made of DNA, and you have non-DNA molecules sitting on the DNA. They're methyl groups and histones for the scientists in the room. But the point is they're not DNA, but they're like, basically they're like librarians in a library. If the DNA are the books, then the epigenetic molecules are the librarians. And if there's a librarian that wants one book to be read every time you come to the library, he or she says, here, read this one, here, read this one, here, read this one. And if there's one he or she doesn't like, put them in a closet and don't let them out. And if you're an author of the book, you know, if you spend all that time writing a book and no one reads it, it's like a book being thrown into a closet. It has no impact unless someone reads it. The same thing is true with genes. Unless they're what's called expressed, they have no influence on anything. So the regulators of gene expression, which basically turns genetic information into proteins that change the way the body works, including the nervous system, these are epigenetic molecules that are librarians of your genes. And so this is important. So epigenetics also influences how these neurons get connected, but then experience influences how they get connected. So the point of the connectome, especially with the cerebral cortex, is it's first of all going to be different in each one of us, even if we're identical twins. Secondly, it's going to be constantly changing. Studies of the brain show that your brain is always responding to experience. So if I do this well as someone joining you in this discussion, your brains will be different when you leave this hall than when you started. Now, I could come up here and just go, thank you for inviting me to come talk about the brain. There's interesting data about the brain and how it changes in teenagers. It really is important to know about it. Any questions? Like that, you'd like fall asleep, or your limbic area would say, you know, let me check my cell phone, or whatever you're going to do. So we engage each other in ways for teachers to do in schools, but also parents to do, that capture the attention and the neuroplasticity of the brain. Okay, so basically this cortex, if you had to say what it does, is it's a bunch of interconnected neurons that map out things. So we have this phrase, neural nets. These are networks of interconnected neurons that map out things, and different regions do different things. So we know, for example, at the simplest level, that if I move my hands like this, how many of you can see me do that? Raise your hand. Okay, so if we put you in a scanner, we know exactly what part of your brain would be responding to me putting my hands like this. We know that when I say hello, we know which part of the brain on the sides would be responding to me saying hello. We know that if I go like that, if I was a good actor and I could act like I was crying and you believed it, which is what actors get paid for, not me, but if you really wanted to know what was Dan feeling inside, we know exactly which area of the brain that does. That's an area that makes maps of minds. I call it mindsight maps. behind your forehead, you have this area that does that. So if we wanted to, we could spend time talking about all the different cortical areas that include the various connected circuits. The main one we're going to talk about now is the frontal area. So it would be from your second to last knuckles down to your fingernails. That's the frontal lobe. Now, there's a frontmost part of the frontal lobe. And does anyone know what that's called? Very good, the prefrontal cortex. And here's your next myth that we're going to debunk. People say, and I've even said it in the past until I read the research literature, people say that adolescents act the way they do in a way that only rental car companies knew because they didn't let a kid less than 25 rent a car. And it's a great joke, and I've used the joke myself, but now I don't do it anymore, except to say that I don't do it anymore. Because we know now that the following statement is not really true. People say it all the time. They say the prefrontal cortex is immature. And that's not true. It's remodeling. And the remodeling that goes on is a very different thing, as you're going to see in a moment when we talk about the dopamine system. This remodeling of the brain is different from calling it immature. Now, you might say, well, that's just different words for the same thing. It's not the same thing, because here's the issue. Immaturity means that you are just waiting to get somewhere else. And if I were an adolescent and I were being told I was immature, I would say to myself, well, where I'm at now is really not very important. I'm just waiting to become an adult, for example. Whereas what I'm offering you is a very different way of thinking about adolescence if you're caring for an adolescent, thinking about adolescence if you are an adolescent, thinking about adolescence if you are a teacher of an adolescent, or even shifting the cultural conversation about adolescence in general, as you'll see in a few minutes. So this issue, is it immaturity, which is, I'm saying, the myth, whereas the truth is it's remodeling. Now, what is the remodeling? Let's just talk about that. Remodeling, in the broadest sense, is that the child, before puberty, basically is having this happen with their brain. And let's just, this is a quick review, but it's helpful to know about developmental neuroscience. Are you ready? Get your hand models, because you're going to need them. Let's lift up our cortex, lift up your limbic area, and what area am I pointing to now? Brainstem, absolutely. So the baby is born, and just an interesting philosophical fact, when the conceptus happens, the sperm and egg, and I hope I'm not shocking anybody, but the sperm and egg, the sperm and egg get together and you form one cell. The cell divides into 2, to 4, to 8, etc., 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, goes on and on and on, until finally this glob of cells is starting to differentiate because some cells are on the outside and some are on the inside. It's kind of, if you've ever been in a, you know, a hotel, you can have like the outside room or the inside room. So this is where they start to be different. Now, what's really, really interesting about the nervous system is the nervous system, whose basic cells are neurons, starts as skin cells. The ectoderm, ecto is outer, derm is layer. The ectoderm is out here, and the ectoderm is going to invaginate inwardly. This is different from the hand model, but the point is that the skin goes inward and becomes the neural tube. The reason I'm even bothering with that is that people often think the brain is just this thing inside the body. But the brain, in some philosophical way, you can think of as fancy skin cells. Seriously. Now, what does your skin do? Your skin is the boundary between the outside world and the inside world, right? So nerves are always about the inner and the outer. So when people get all excited and shocked that the brain is a social organ, I say to them, well, think about the origin of all nerves. They come from skin cell origins, so of course it's going to be social. It's constantly wanting to know what's going on inside, what's going on outside. That's what the nervous system is all about. So as we're about to review developmental neurobiology, I wanted you to understand, you got to start with that premise. So when your adolescent is having his or her brain remodeling, you got to know it's always about the inside world and the outside world. So don't think, oh, brain remodeling is just inside. No. The brain is a social organ and it's a bodily regulatory organ. It's always doing both. Okay, so the conceptus gets together, the cells start to differentiate, and ultimately the beginning in the uterus is that the brain stem becomes really well formed. And the brain essentially is going to grow in the womb, bottom up. So it gets to really mature here, and then the limbic area is partially developed. So how well developed do you think the cortex is when the baby's born? Not much at all. There are neurons there, they've been set up by genes, but now they are ready to be formed by experience. And the first 18 to 24 months of life, the prefrontal region develops in a huge way, we believe in our field, interpersonal neurobiology, based on the communication you have within attachment relationships. So you form this area of the brain that is going to start to regulate your emotions and regulate your attention and regulate your thinking and regulate your behavior. This is the regulatory area of the brain. And it does that through a really interesting process called integration. Integration is the linkage of differentiated parts. And I want you to take your hand model now. So we've said that the brain stem is fully developed at birth, pretty much. The limbic area partially developed. What's this top area called? Cortex. And it's not very well developed. The first 2 years of life, attachment relationships will shape the development, especially of the front of the front, called the prefrontal cortex. And take a look at your prefrontal region, which is from your last knuckles to your fingernails. Lift up in your brain model, please. Don't faint. Well, if you faint, that's okay. We'll pick you up. But do a little dissection here. Lift it up and put it down. What do you notice is unique about the position of the prefrontal cortex? It covers everything, exactly. So it's part of the cortex. It takes information, which are basically energy patterns of electrochemical energy transformations. That's what the brain is all about, electrochemical energy transformations. It takes that energy, and some of it is information. It comes through the cortex. It connects cortical energy flow with limbic flow. It even receives direct input from the brainstem. It's got straight stuff coming up from the body. And amazingly, through the senses, it picks up what's happening in other people's nervous systems. So those are five areas. Let's name them. Let's name the five sources of energy and information flow that the prefrontal cortex links together. One is cortical. The next is limbic. Next, brainstem, body, and the social world. So when we say it's an integrative area, we're not just being like we're from California or something. I can say that because I am from California. It's a very specific term, linking differentiated parts. Differentiated means special, unique. They're different from each other. Link means to connect them. The prefrontal region, it isn't that it's super special. It's that it is one of the most integrative areas of the brain. If you sadly are neglected, severely neglected in childhood, this area doesn't grow well. Neither do other integrative regions like the corpus callosum connecting left and right, or the hippocampus and the limbic area. But we'll stick with the prefrontal region for now. If you do have secure attachment, we believe that this area integrates beautifully. Now we're only talking about a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old. So how you've had attachment experiences then shapes how you enter preschool. And then your experience in school will continue to shape this. So in schools, I say, let's have a prefrontal education. So you're teaching people how to integrate. That's what the whole brain child that I wrote with Tina Bryson is all about. How you do that, how you help kids integrate their nervous system, including the prefrontal cortex. Okay, so now basically from 3 to 12, the child is like a sponge. This brain is just going to soak in knowledge from adults and other kids. Soak it in, soak it in, soak it in, soak it in, soak it in. Why do we need to do that? Because we are an unbelievably complex, socially intricate species. And unlike, you know, I used to raise guinea pigs at home. You know, the guinea pigs give birth. It's really cool to watch. Within like a few hours, those guinea pigs are out grazing. And I never see a mom guinea pig particularly teaching the baby anything. You know, they just all graze and it's really fun. I like to pet them when I was a kid. We had like two dozen of them. It was fantastic. But you don't see much teaching going on. Why do we need to teach anything? And why is that baby guinea pig, like, you know, still, you know, getting milk, but she's going out, checking out the grass right away? What's going on there? Why do we people need to teach? Why do we have to have schools? Well, we have one of the longest dependencies of any species. Think about it. How long is your child dependent on you? 40 years. Not if you do the adolescence thing right, which you'll do after taking the brainstorm approach. But we have a dependency that goes on, let's say, at least 18 years, right? So 18 is what percentage of a lifetime? Well, we don't want to say it because we'll be superstitious. Oh, don't make my life end. But assuming you live, let's say, about 100 years, and let's say that's about 20 years, it's about a fifth, right? That's a long time to be dependent. A fifth of your life, you're dependent. Right? But that's what it is, because we have a very complex, extremely complex social species, and you need to learn things from other people. That's why the brain is soaking it in. Then what changes at 12 is that there's changes in the limbic area and changes in a system that goes from the brainstem to the limbic area to the cortex called the dopamine system, which is basically the system of reward. And it's controversial, so people in science have arguments about everything, but one of the proposals is that you drop the baseline dopamine level, but you raise the squirted, secreted level. Now, that combination is very interesting, because dopamine is what you release if you do something that's rewarding. Like if you like to cook and you cook a good meal for people you love, you'll have a dopamine release and you're going to feel that was really rewarding. If you like to play tennis and you learn a new stroke and you go practice it and then you play a game and you do well, your dopamine will rise and you'll say, that was really a great game. You know, if you're someone nutty like me, you like writing books, you know, you work for years writing something and then finally you get it done and then you edit it and you change it, you edit it, you change it, and then finally you're standing on stage, I think my dopamine is rising because this took a lot of work. It's a lot of disciplined effort, right? If your dopamine drops, it makes you feel utsy. It makes you feel restless. It makes you feel like something isn't quite right. Do any of you know any adolescents who feel that? But when the release levels are higher, it means that this individual, with this now change in the dopamine system, is going to be driven to do something that is one of the biggest kinds of activities that release dopamine. And does anyone know what it is? It's novelty. Some people said sex. Yeah, I guess it could be sex too. It's novelty, which can be also something involving sex. So it's novelty, doing something new, not doing the same old, same old. The brain is wired to try new things, and it gets familiar very soon, so it wants to do new things.
Daniel Siegel, the author of Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. He spoke at Town Hall on December 13th, 2013, in a lecture presented by ParentMap. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOW Speakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Cornish College of the Arts, presenting Creative Society, January 31st and February 1st, exploring the ways in which creativity and artistic practice can bring new approaches to human health and well-being. Information at cornish.edu/creativesociety. 10 o'clock, 94.9 KUOW. I'm Bill O'Grady.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.